Hey, folks. In the interest of full disclosure, the two guests on this week's show are personal friends of mine. There's no business relationship between us, but we hang out sometimes, and that's something people generally want to know when they're hearing an interview about a product. I have no personal stake in the success of the Castle of Cagliostro disc, but I felt I should disclose that these two guys are friends of mine before the show. Sometimes people want to know, and can't hurt to, you know, spill it. Anyway, hope you enjoy the show. Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. I think you will. Everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Very special guests, friends of the show, some returning champions, and sometimes employees of Discotheque. They have the blessing of the owner of Discotheque. You've heard him on the show before. It's Brady Hartle. Brady, thanks for coming on the show.
Yay, thanks for having me, Zach.
And also on the show, joining us, I think, for the first time?
Yep, first time.
Yeah, okay. You can find his stuff at looponthethird.com, right?
That's it.
And he's a producer on, along with Brady, on the most recently released Castle of Cagliostro Blu-ray that's out right now. Reed
that's
Nelson
right.
is here. Reed, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It'll be a pleasure.
Okay, so this just came out, so that must be a relief.
Yes, actually finally in people's hands and not on our hard drives.
It was delayed for a really long time. Like, it was supposed to come out last year, right?
The plan was to have it out, I think, by the end of last year.
Or it was early. It was supposed to be like January, I think, actually.
Well, it was the goal was to either have it by the end of the year or early this year. Like January-ish, yeah.
Right.
We were hoping for December. I was really pulling for December. We just had too much and it just didn't happen.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get into the reasons for that here in a bit, but just so people understand your role, because you're both sort of contract employees, could you just sort of describe what it is you do for Discotheque? And Brady, why don't you start?
So primarily I do package design. If you've picked up any of their Lupons or the Cardcaptor Soccer movie or Samurai Troopers or like the recent Shin Mazinger or this, I did all the packaging design and the disc, the menus, I designed all that. And on this title and a number of titles, I'm sort of a producer/project manager, which sort of means I sort of wrangle all the assets and look what we need to request from the licensors and see what exists and all that. And I've done that on a number of titles. I did it on Cyber Six and this one, and I think a couple others, but those are the two main ones.
Right. And Reed?
Kind of some of the same stuff, except not so much the artwork stuff, obviously.
Right.
But I really just mostly for the Lupon projects, I go, okay, well, what was available in Japan? Can we get some of these things? Make sure the translations look good. Check for typos, that sort of thing. Write liner notes, that sort of stuff. I'm not nearly as involved as Brady's been.
I don't know. I'd say you do it. There's a lot of work in the subtitles and the liner notes and all that. I mean, pretty much for the Lupon stuff, Reed and I don't want to say we're like what is the word for it? The
Wonder Twins?
No, the Lupon Wonder Twins. I mean, we more or less sort of like Selby lets us do pretty much what we need to do to get these things done and have them be good releases, more or less.
Right. And if it's a project that we're really passionate about, like, say, the Castle of Cagliostro, we really push for making it as good a release as we can, like, in, you know, with a little extra oomph, because, you know, we know there's good stuff and we want to make it, you know, we want to make it full and bursting. But, you know, like the TV specials and stuff, well, you can only do so much.
Right. Interesting. So I guess, like, how did Cagliostro come to be? Like, that's kind of a major title for a company like Discotech to pick up. I mean, Discotech is known for, if people aren't familiar, releasing, you know, obscurities and fan favorite, like niche, like sort of cult favorites from the past, like the 80s and the 90s. And, you know, they put out stuff like the complete run of Samurai Pizza Cats and, you know, the Mega Man TV show and, you know, some really cool stuff as well, obviously, like the Fatal Fury movie and like upcoming. They've got like Vampire Hunter D Bloodlust and so some really cool stuff. But Castle of Cagliostro, like, if you said, oh, that's going to Discotech, I would have looked at you funny because that's, you know, pretty solid seller. It's changed hands through a lot of different companies over the years. And I'm just like, how did that come to be?
So as far as I understand it, and it's sort of right, you would think that a lot of companies would fight over it or whatever.
I don't know about that. Like, it is an old movie, but you would think somebody like G Kids or somebody would pick it up, you know?
Yeah, because it's a classic. What I think happens is that, and what he, you know, the Mr. Discotech sort of intimated to me is that because he released all of these older Lupin titles and he seems to be sticking with Lupin, they like, you know, how he treats the franchise and how he does things, and he actually gets it out there and he seems to make a profit. So I guess he had sort of proved himself with all the other Lupin titles, and so they granted that license to him because of his track record with the franchise and how he tends to treat it.
I kind of got the impression that it was, I think he probably acquired a lot of the licenses that we've seen surrounding Cagliostro, either simultaneously or near that license, and that probably helped kind of give him a little boost as far as getting that as well.
Right. Well, that's cool. So, I mean, that must have been when you found out about that they were going to be doing this legendary film. I mean, Reed, what was your first reaction to being told you were going to get the chance to work on the Blu-ray?
It was pretty enthusiastic. I was just totally jazzed. My wife was less excited about it because she knew I would be spending a lot of time on it. And I was just totally just psyched. I was hooting and hollering.
Right. I think it's the first time the phrase hooting and hollering has ever been used on the podcast. So congratulations. And Brady, what was that? Has that so far been like the most prestigious thing that you've worked on?
In terms of anime, for I would anime, think so. Yeah. In anime, I think so. Because I've done a lot of video game packaging and all that for bigger titles, but yeah, this, and it's one of the, it's one of those ones I said, if I ever got a chance to work on that, I'd want to do it right. Like, I 100% sort of seek this out. I had said at some point, I said, you know, if I could work on that, I would work on it for free, which is sort of the famous last words. And Reed was like, well, hold on. And then he got me in touch with Selby and Discotech, and here I am, kind of.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. So, I mean, that must have also been kind of scary, because now, I mean, once the holy shit, we get to work on this, once that goes away, then you're like, oh, we have to make this really good. Like, we have to really make it, like, go way out of our way to make this incredible, because that would be the definitive version for this current generation of media.
Right, you don't get a second chance on things like this, really.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, probably not.
Especially because Blu-ray is expensive to, you know, press and all that, too.
Right.
There's a lot of moving parts, and, you know, this release had multiple dubs, and then there's the, you know, the Japanese version, and you have to service that, and then you have to make sure the subtitles are good, and yeah, there's a lot of moving parts on this, and, you know, since it's so old, also, there's all the discovery of where can I find the materials, how can I get them,
versions of them, and
yeah, who has what. I mean, before I even, you know, got started, I more or less bought every version of the Castle of Cagliostro I could find just to see what existed and what could we request from the licensor. And I mean, sitting on my desk right now, I mean, I have like, I've got the older manga version. I've got the Japanese version that from Disney. I've got the Japanese VAP version. I have the French Le Chateau de Cagliostro Blu-ray DVD set. I've got the Australian version. I've got all these different versions of this movie, the UK version, just so I can see what exists, what can we request, what did they do, what did they do right, what did they do wrong, because I knew that this title was one everybody was really anticipating.
Well, yeah, and also tax write-offs. But but I of course bought a lot of that stuff just because I'm a nerd, and I have a lot of those things, same things too. I actually still have some things of Brady's from that whole venture that I need to mail to him. Like we got some of the like the old storyboard book from the early 80s. They did a version of the storyboards, printed it, that are an inferior quality, but they had some cool artwork in them. And hey, can we use this? Well, we couldn't use those, but I mean, you know, so we sought out a bunch of old like magazines and things that we got to get optimal versions of artwork that we were allowed to use. And like the stuff that hasn't been in print for since the early 80s.
Yeah, and, was the magazine? It was like Film 1/24 that had all these beautiful watercolors that we got permission to use. Yeah,
because Miyazaki, you know, he does all the watercolor prototype stuff that he does before he starts the actual project and really gets into it. And we've went back and found all of the old ones. I had a Japanese acquaintance who's huge on Lupin, and he had a little archive of low-res versions of them. And it's like, well, these are all right, but they're not good enough. And so we went and got the books, found the fanzines and stuff, and imported them and scanned them as good we could and put them in when we got permission. So,
yeah, I mean, you're not necessarily working with original material on a lot of this stuff. It sounds like you're basically collecting what special features and extra stuff exists out there in the wild in terms of like on other DVDs, like produced in other regions, then you ask for permission to use that stuff. I mean, it's not like they're sending you the master tapes for some special feature that they cut 15, 20 years ago, right?
Well, no, they sent us the masters for a lot of the stuff. We like for everything, you know, you can't just, you know, rip it. So you have to like request it through them and see what we can use or if they have the master or not.
Yeah, right. You're getting permission. I would imagine if they have the originals, they'll send you that. Otherwise, they give you permission to use what's out there, right? In some cases?
Well, yeah, for some cases, yeah. It depends on what it is.
Like, sometimes we'll maybe get something, and it isn't as, like, we'll get permission to use something, but the version they sent isn't as nice as something that we have, and so we just use the nicer version that we have. Like, but that doesn't happen all that often, but it happens sometimes.
So long as they're okay with it, they give us permission. Yeah, it's all right, exactly. It's all down to them. Like, it's all down to the rights holders for the most part. But yeah,
right, because
like,
they still have to okay everything. So.
Yeah, they have to okay every single thing, which was like on this project was more so than a lot of other ones because this is sort of their biggest Lupin movie. That they have.
Of course. Did you wind up spending a lot of time waiting to hear back from approvals?
Yeah, the worst thing that almost did not get on there was the storyboard mode, which for whatever reason for a long time, they didn't even think they had the rights to it, which is sort of weird because it's their movie. And we went back and forth with them about it and like showing them your copyright's right here. You obviously own this. And back and forth and back and forth. And it took us a long time for them to you know figure out that they did own it and give us permission to put that on there, and that almost didn't make it, but I'm like so ecstatic that at the very last minute they were like, oh yeah, you can put that on there, you have our permission now. I was like, oh thank God. Like for instance, one of the things we could not get permission for, like if you look at this release versus all the older releases, the only omission is the Yasuo Otsuka interview from the manga version. And for whatever reason, nobody had any of the contracts or anything that exists for that anymore. And so we could not include that. And we could not, like, you know, we went through a lot to try and figure out who might own it. Like, we asked the people who own Manga Video Now, Stars, and we asked them, you know, do you have any of the contracts, the rights, or any of this? And they had no idea what we're talking about in that terms of that extra. And then, of course, the TMS had no, you know, they didn't know it either. So we just could not include that one, unfortunately.
Right, and I know the goal was to basically get as much stuff on there as you possibly could. So, like, this thing has, what, like, 3 different English dub tracks on it?
So, okay, yeah. So, we in terms of audio tracks, there are, there's obviously the Japanese and the 5, there's a, you know, a cool 5.1 mix of that. There's the 19.2 dub, which is also known as the Streamlined dub. That was, they sent a master of that. We restored it. I found an actual VHS tape of it because the version they sent was not really in sync. And then I resynced that by hand to the original release of sync and restored it. Then there's the 2000 version, which stars David Hayter, which is known as the manga dub. And for that one, we went back to the original sources. For that, we actually found the master stems for that. And then we took it back to the person who mixed it back in 2000, Les Claypool, who's known for doing, like, Trigun and Cowboy Bebop.
And not from Primus.
Not Les Claypool from Primus, but known for dubbing things for animes. What else? I mean, he's done, like, a who's who of, like, anime, Macross Plus, all the Ghosts in the Shells, like, all that sort of stuff. And we went back to him. He took the materials and he did a completely new, 100% new mix on that digitally after we, you know, dumped the original materials.
And that was really last minute. It was cutting pretty close to our wire. And he was only able to pull off a 2.0.
Yeah.
A 5.1 would have required a lot more time and probably more resources and stuff.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is that the 5.1 that exists for that on the older manga DVD was a fake 5.1. So it really doesn't sound better than what we did. What we did sounds better anyway, even though it's 2.0. Mm-hmm. But did that. And then, you know, that sounds great. It sounds way better than that dub has ever sounded. It's almost all completely real stereo. The music is better now, everything. And then finally, there's also the family-friendly dub, which I guess Reed can talk about that because it's kind of his baby.
Yeah, the family-friendly dub isn't a unique dub per se. It's really just the manga dub. But it was something I worked on in my spare time originally because I just thought, you know, I like this dub. I'd like to watch it more, but there's a lot of cursing in it. And that kind of annoys me because that wasn't how the movie was written originally. And so, like, okay, well, what if I just snip out all or some of the cursing, would it make it more palatable? And the answer is, I think, yes. And so that's just something I did pretty lousily in my free time. And Brady thought it was a good idea. And so we pursued it, and we did a version for the DVD. He finished that. He made that work in a, you know, something that's commercially, commercially usable. And then when we after talking to Les we ended up having we had the stems at, you know, leading up to talking to Les, and so we utilized that to craft a new version of that, which actually when we were going back over it, I found another curse word that I'd never heard before in the dub because the levels were different. And so it was like, oh, okay. But yeah, so we went back through and removed almost all the cursing. There's a few words still in there that would have been inelegant to remove. And so, but yeah, I think it makes the movie sound more like how Miyazaki intended it to be, like something that was more, you know, it's kind of a more family friendly, so to speak, version of the Lupin franchise anyway. So having something that's loaded with a bunch of curse words just didn't really seem like something you'd want to show, like, you know, a lot of parents would want to show a 7-year-old kid, you know, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's more or less similar to what Disney did with Kiki's Delivery Service or Laputa, where they went back to the dub and all the sort of alterations which weren't congruous with the original Japanese script, they sort of changed, like they changed some of the the dialogue towards the end of Kiki's and all that, and it's sort of a version of Cagliostro that is more in line with the original Japanese version, which didn't have all that heavy amount of cussing that was added to the manga dub. So we wanted to do that, and so we did. We ended up doing it and getting it put on there, and what Reed was saying is we were able to use the new mix that we got from Les, and then it was a lot easier to just have to, you know, go in and massage it here and there, and made it go a lot faster. I think I ended up redoing that 3 or 4 times with the better materials.
Yeah, definitely.
And it worked out. It worked out in the end.
It showed, yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, that's sort of how that came about. And it's, you know, it's a version of that dub you can show your kids. And the thing is if you like that original dub, it's on there. It's not like we didn't include all the version with all the cussing in it or anything. So it's all there.
Well, I mean, how did the licensor respond to that? I mean, you must have had to have gotten permission to edit a dub that, you know, I mean, you weren't asked to do that. It was just something you decided to do. So what was the, like, how long did it take you to get them to say yes to that?
Well, as far as we understand it, they approved it. So
how did they respond to the request? Hey, we would like to edit the existing dub and take out the swearing. Like, I'm just curious how if you even know how the licensor responded to that request.
Not at all. I mean, like, we said we want to do this. We sent our list of stuff. They went down our list and said, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And the other ones, they were like, you can do these ones. And so we did the ones we're allowed to do, and that was one of the ones we were allowed to do.
Interesting.
We weren't, like, banging on doors. Like, so what did they exactly say about this? Like, you know.
I would just be nervous because that's kind of taken – you're playing with fire a little bit there. I mean, did you get any pushback from, like, Lupin fans, like, on forums when you mentioned that was going to be on there?
So one guy told us...
There's that one guy.
Yeah, there's one guy told us we're horrible and we're going to ruin it. Even though the fact that we're like, well, the original's on here. It's right here. So...
yeah.
So one guy got upset about it.
Yeah, one guy got up in arms, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
otherwise, honestly, people have been actually very complimentary and thankful about it. Like, oh, hey, thanks, I can show this to my kids. Or, I mean, David Hayter specifically, he had watched it with his daughter. He was like, I didn't realize there was so much cussing in this. And he was very enthusiastic about, you know, something like this being included as well. So... sort of a cool little thing, and it seems people were really excited about it and hopefully are enjoying it.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Yeah, no, I was just curious, like, what the reception was to something like that, because I think that's the first time I've heard of that happening, somebody basically un-17ing a dub.
I mean, it's not really that different than what Disney did with the...
Well,
the,
they're not removing curse words from Kiki's Delivery Service.
No. But they're removing dialogue.
But I will say, they did that, but I will say it's kind of like we're bringing the dub back in line to how Disney records their dubs, like with Nausicaa. Nausicaa doesn't really have hardly any, if any, cursing in it, in their English dub of it. So it's like, well... Why isn't this dub more like that to begin with?
Yeah, there's plenty of cursing.
But they don't go back and, like, alter it in that way. You're right. So this is kind of a first.
There's plenty of cursing in Nausicaa. She's like, we gotta save this fucking forest.
Fucking bitches.
Are you sure that's not the Warriors of the Wind? Anyway.
Yeah, sure, right. Yeah. I have not listened to that manga dub in a very long time. I had completely forgotten that there was that much cursing in it. But I can totally believe it, because that's what they did back then. That's interesting. So what was, like, the biggest headache to procure? Like, what was the hardest thing to get your hands on?
Materials wise?
Yeah.
Oh, what would that be, Reed? Cause there was a lot of,
I'm thinking.
There was a lot of, this one, I mean, there was
whoa,
a lot of,
whoa, 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 whoa. Resource copy of the 80 subtitles, probably.
Oh, you mean the
reference copy? I mean
the reference. Yeah. That actually took quite a while to find that. So,
yeah, because here, quick recap is the licensor in part of the package of stuff we initially got sent us the original working script for the original 1980 theatrical subtitles that, you know, debuted locally and at a local level, like, oh, in California they're screening it at, you know, this one thing or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, just right. the one that, the print that went everywhere. And I thought, oh, this is great. We could put these on the disc. And because, I mean, obviously they sent them to us. They don't have a problem with us using them. And but they but I wanted to check, you know, like, what did the subtitles look like? What did they were they accurately transcribed onto the screen? You know, that kind of stuff. And so we found a bootleg copy in the wild from, you know, decades ago, and from a good friend of mine, actually, and he sent it to us, and we actually had Brady, who did that for us, who compared the tape and the script.
My buddy Ian Wright, who helps I do production stuff for us on our various Discotech projects. He went through the script, and he transcribed the whole thing to an actual subtitle script for us. And yeah, to sort of explain what that extra is back in, I guess, 1980, TMS created a theatrical print of the movie using a subtitle script that they created, which actually called the movie Cliffhanger 2 or something like that.
Although the script looks like it actually has the Cliffhanger 2 part might have been put on like after the fact.
Oh.
We don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just the script we got a scan of the script, and so we got the actual a copy of somebody somehow bootlegged a copy of that print, and we watched it, and we wanted to preserve that as a feature. Like, this is what it would have been like to watch this movie if you had seen it back when it premiered in America, which I guess they must have showed it in the early 80s, and then that script was that print was shopped around by Streamline to like little indie theaters, and that's how it played in around like 92 or something like that. So
right, yeah, they got the same old print, and I understand it was really ratty, and of course we didn't want it to be exactly the same, because if you actually watch the subtitles on that theatrical print, if you were ever so lucky, they were pretty ugly, because they were really like, they had this weird sparkling effect. I don't remember exactly how you.
They look like a typewriter. They look like a typewriter.
Yeah,
so
it's the old burned in white subs.
Yeah,
So we
kind of recreated those close to the experience of the original theatrical showing, and typos and all, weird names, everything, grammar errors, everything, and it's on there as a subtitle track. So that's sort of what that is.
And so when you watch that on the Blu-ray, the subtitle font is huge, and that's how it looked in, you know, text to picture ratio in the original theatrical version.
So now you just need to find an untouched like two screen cinema from, you know, circa 1980 or whatever, and project it onto the ratty old screen, and you'll have like the full experience.
we need to like run it through like a VHS deck first, and then project it.
Yeah, totally. So the film itself, like, now that you've seen it, you know, 800 billion times, I'm sure, in the last year, like, what's your takeaway from the film? Like, do you think it's – what did you think of it before, and now how do you view the film? And I guess, Brady, I'll start with you.
It might not be his best movie, but I feel it's my favorite Miyazaki movie. I'm a fan of animation in general, and there's just like there's just so many amazing scenes in it. From a perspective of just liking animation, obviously the car chase or any of the stuff where they're swimming through the ducts or him fighting the count in the clock tower, all that sort of stuff is just if you're a fan of animation, like if you haven't watched that, you're really not a fan of animation, I think. But
jeez, harsh words.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, though, I mean, it's you look at that. You don't have to like the movie, but you have to at least seen that, you know. And like, if you look at that car chase, I mean, somebody did that in 1979 with no computers or anything, like just figured that out. And it's amazing to watch that this is a movie that's, you know, what, 30, 35 years old. What is it?
It would be 35th anniversary was last December, yeah.
Yeah, so 35 years old, and it's still, you know, just, I don't know. There are certain things in the movie that captivate me, and I think it's a good – it's a very Miyazaki movie. I guess a lot of the it's got a lot of that, you know, conservation and whatever messages that Miyazaki likes to put in his movies. It's a little bit in there, but it's a lot, it's pulled back from his later works quite a bit because, you know, he's working within the confines of another person's creation versus how Nausicaa and all these, you know. I guess, no, he actually does a lot of adaptations, so what am I saying?
yeah. No, no, I get
but
what
he was
saying.
He was literally like knee deep in another intellectual property that was owned by, you know, another Japanese company that was kind of lording over them. I mean, so he had his limitations in that way.
Yeah, well, yeah. This was his first film. You know, if the Miyazaki of today were to make a Lupin movie, he could make whatever he felt like.
Yeah,
the Miyazaki of 1979 had to make, you know, what they wanted him to.
Sort of within, yeah, within the boundaries of what he knew he could get away with. But yeah, no, I mean, I feel like, I mean, the movie on its own is just, it has a sense of like wonderment to it that I like. You know, it just keeps going. I don't know. Reed probably has more to say about it than me.
Well, you're stealing all the good stuff, but I mean, the movie is just a fun ride. Like, there's no pacing issues that are like anything worth mentioning in this movie. Like it just keeps going. And even when it slows down, it's still kind of giving you something. And the animation is superb for something that was rushed out in like, you know, 4 months of animation and just shoot. I mean, I've shown the movie to people and I go, when do you think this was made? And they would say, you know, mid-80s or later, because they assume that's like something with a budget that was really, you know, even newer, even though the clothes and stuff are obviously a little dated. But it just looks so good and it's so compelling and so well done, they assume it has to be newer, you know, because obviously newer is better, right? But no, it's so much fun. It's timeless. It's just a timeless film.
Okay, so after having seen it a billion times and working on it for a year, your enthusiasm for the film has not dampened.
No, I mean, when we were in the middle of, like, crunch time, we were like, man, this movie is the worst thing ever made, is how we felt. You know, but it was – but it's still – I mean, I can go back and rewatch that Blu-ray. Like, it's so good. But it's also because I don't have any pressure or deadlines or anything to worry about. It's more like, okay, yeah, I can just sit back and relax and watch it. It's a great movie. It's just – it holds up on rewatching. I mean, it's – there are a lot of Lupin projects that do not hold up on rewatching.
Yeah, sure. It's just my point was basically like if you really, really love something and you get too close to it, like you are immersed in it, you have to like live and breathe it for a really long period of time. Sometimes that changes your relationship with it, and that was the focus of that question.
Yeah, here's I guess to a testament to the movie is that by the end of it, I had watched the movie so many times that I could just literally, along with the various dubs, just recite all the lines to it. And I got the final mix for the 2.0 from Les Claypool, and I was like, I have to watch this again. I don't want to watch this again. I've watched this so many times, over and over again. And I started to watch it. In the beginning, I was like, I've seen these scenes so many times. The car chase, this. But as I got into it, I sat down and just realized just how, like, the movie's good enough that after all that, I really got into it. And then it was over. And I was like, wow. Like, and it's just like a testament to it that I can go from, like, oh, I don't want to watch this again to, man, this is an amazing movie. How is it over already? You know, like it was very much that, like, and that was in knee deep, and I have to get all this stuff done by this date so we could, you know, make this print date and all that sort of stuff. And even then, it sort of worked its hooks into me, and I found myself enjoying it again.
Do you think that it's the best Lupin thing, like the best incarnation, like the single best thing to have come out of that franchise?
Me personally, yes. I think this and my other favorite is, Lupin Green versus Red, which does something a little different with Lupin, but those are my two absolute favorite Lupin things, I would have to say, without a doubt.
What about you, Reed?
I think it's easily the best crafted, like it's just excellent craftsmanship, excellent storytelling. So it's really at the top in that way, but as something that reflects the Lupin intellectual property, it does a really good job. But it isn't quite number one. Like, so it's a great movie within the – so I guess in the literal sense, as – if you look at everything in the Lupin spectrum, it's probably the one best thing, like speaking from a broad perspective. But speaking as something that is a Lupin thing, probably something like The Mystery of Mamo is more like, okay, well, this is Lupin, or, you know, key episodes in like the second series or the first series. Some of those are really, really pretty strong stuff that are like, okay, that encapsulates Lupin very well. But is entertaining and is really good. But yeah, there's a great argument. I would say, yeah, I'm pretty much there. I think it is the best one single Lupin thing, even though, you know, hardcore Lupin fans will go, oh, Castle Cagliostro is terrible as a reflection of the series. But that's not necessarily a problem.
You know? I mean, if you look at it, Mr. Mamo is sort of the epitome of Monkey Punch's Lupin. And Miyazaki's Lupin is very different from Monkey Punch's Lupin. I mean, in this movie, he's essentially – I mean, this movie is – I mean, when it came out, it was, you know, set – eras before you've, you know, it's set in like the late 60s, early 70s versus, you know, and it came out in 79, and it was already sort of a period thing then. And it's supposed to be sort of like in Lupin's, the twilight of his career, where, you know, his things are winding down. He's a little more wise and all of that. And I think people sort of overlook that when they say, oh, well, Lupin's a little, he's too chivalrous. He's, you know, he's too nice. He's not enough of a pervert in this movie. And they don't look at it in that context, I guess.
Right. And that's easy to do because people don't – I don't think people really understand that. Like, that's not clear. They just take the movie. They see it for what it's worth. And they don't – Miyazaki doesn't drop super strong hints that that's the case. Like, he does have the bit kind of toward the end of the movie where he does a flashback and kind of implies that Lupin's more crazy adventurous days are behind him. But I don't think people look at the movie in that way. They just go, oh, this isn't like the other Lupins I saw, therefore not as good, or therefore turns me off or whatever. But when you understand that it is a time shift ahead of everything else Lupin you've watched, and this is supposed to be kind of a series finale, like that's okay. Well, that's – I think that helps me really better appreciate how he took a look at the series, because he's still showing respect for the show as it was originally intended, even though he didn't really care for Monkey Punch's take on Lupin. You know, in 1979, he thought, well, this is outdated. This isn't relevant anymore. So let me make it relevant. Let me make it work. And that's how he ended up with Cagliostro, because he wanted to make Lupin a character that he could identify with and be more interesting.
Well, I mean, you're both wrong, first of all. The best Lupin thing is a woman called Fujiko Mine, so you can correct your opinions.
I'm not laughing because you're wrong, but I mean, everyone's better.
I think Woman Called Fujiko Mine is the best Lupin thing, like, just from a storytelling standpoint and everything else. But, you know...
No, I think it's great, too. That's probably in my top three, so I'm not...
Right,
I'm
yeah.
Not,
I'm joking around about the whole best thing. But that's interesting. Because I think that's kind of... It's the only Lupin thing most people have had any contact with. Mm. And the fact that it is also held up as the best, I'm sort of, you know, curious if that's a function of just it being, like... Do you think the quality of the film 100% stands on its own and its reputation in the United States comes from its pedigree? Or do you think the pedigree is what means – what make like so people watch it because of the pedigree and they almost universally do not move on to watch other Lupin stuff? So like where do you think the gap is? Like people are only watching it because it's a Miyazaki film? Like what do you make of the legacy of this movie in the U.S.?
If I may say, I think you're right about the pedigree thing, and that people will watch it and then they'll go, oh, okay, that was pretty fun. That was a good time. But I mean, first, for a long time, we didn't know it was a Lupin the Third film. Like in the 90s, he was the wolf, you know, so a lot of people who watched it back then would have only known it was the wolf. So they didn't know that there was a Lupin franchise to pursue, or maybe wouldn't have pieced together once Lupin things started coming out because they knew him as the wolf. And then the manga version comes out. I think we saw an influx of Lupin fans, but I think the reason that people don't jump from Miyazaki fan to Lupin fan is because Cagliostro does feel different from Miyazaki's other films, I think in a good way. But Miyazaki's later films exercise a little more like creativity in setting, and they tend to, you know, do a lot of the things that Miyazaki is really into, like, oh, okay, well let's talk about the environment and that sort of stuff. And Cagliostro doesn't really play that game. And I think it feels off for people in that way, because they're expecting a certain thing and they go, oh, okay, I can see that he's starting to kind of get his bearings here, but he's not the My Neighbor Totoro Miyazaki. He's not the Spirited Away Miyazaki. He's, you know, so I think that probably has something to do with it.
I mean, yeah, I think the Cagliostro is like, you know, his sort of underlying message is, you know, and it reflects in his other series 2 episodes too. It's all usually about money and greed, and it's really light in Cagliostro. His sort of message about money and greed and what it'll get you in the end, and his same thing with Albatross Wings of Death is the same sort of thing. Kind of repeats himself.
Right, with that being the Lupin TV episodes that Miyazaki directed, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Those two. Yeah, late in the second series.
Yeah, which basically lay out his visual inspiration. Like, all of his visual concepts are in those episodes.
Yeah, like
everything he would use for the next, like, 5 to 10 years is in those episodes.
Yeah, and he did 2 episodes. He did Albatross Wings of Death and was it Farewell, My Beloved Lupin? It was the very final
episode.
Yeah,
it's something like that. And of course, like you said, that's the latter of the two, the series finale, had a character who looked just like Nausicaa in it. And
same voice.
Right, yeah, Sumi Shimamoto, who also did Clarice. And she's driving a robot that looks just like the one from Laputa, Castle in the Sky.
It's fun times. Maybe somebody will eventually, you know, put those out in some fashion, you know, aside from the Streamline tape or whatever that...
Well, they are out on Hulu as dubs.
Oh, they are. Okay, yeah. So they are available. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, if people are interested in the legacy of this stuff, go look that up. It's interesting to see. Okay, so the disc is out. You've gotten lots of praise for it. A lot of people, you know, talking it up. So far, like, did you take anything away from that project? Like, if you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently?
Okay, not be as ambitious. Scale it back at least a little bit. If you look at the disc is literally, it's a BD-50, and it is packed to the gills. There's no more room on it, and we more or less got too much stuff together. We were just too ambitious, too much stuff. It's a good release, and it's got a lot of great stuff on it, but we killed ourselves putting this disc together, because production on this, you know, Disc Deck's a small company, so production on this disc was more or less me and Reed for content and whoever else we could contract for what little money we had. And so it was a lot of us burning the midnight oil, putting in our own hours. And I designed all the menus. I did all the if you look at the art extras and all that, I did all the animation for that. And I edited those together. I put together the interview with David Hayter, Bob Bergen. All that stuff was mostly my time and free time, and Reed helping me with the as much as he could with the visual stuff. And it just took us a long, long time, and it was just way too ambitious, I guess.
Reed?
Yeah, sorry. Better communication, I think, is would have helped a lot too. I mean, I don't. Brady's right, but also better communication, because sometimes maybe we didn't. Communicate on, okay, well, we need to do this, and this needs to get done, and it needs to get done this way, and it needs to get done this way. And also check in, like, with Justin, who did our disc for us. We probably could have communicated better with him to let him know what exactly we had in mind, so that he didn't feel overwhelmed when we were going to the final phase. And just kind of keep open lines all in all directions at all times, instead of ending up with dead ends where we thought we were going to be able to go ahead with something and it didn't work out that way. And
okay. Yeah. Well, a big project like that, you always learn something.
That's the thing we learned. Don't be that ambitious.
Right. So Reed, you're still working on Lupin stuff for Discotech. Can you share what you're working on right now?
It's nothing super, not much super interesting to report, but, I've been just kind of looking over, the Lupin versus Conan TV special.
Right.
And I think Brady's been doing something with that as well.
Yeah, I'm doing the packaging. I do pretty much all the packaging for Lupin stuff, so I'm working on that now and a number of other things, both of those.
Yeah, so I'm going to – basically all you can really expect on that release is, as far as extras go, is probably going to be some liner notes that are going to kind of help you. Okay, well, if you're a Lupin fan but you're not familiar with Detective Conan, or Case Closed as it is known in the United States, you know, familiarize yourself with those characters a little bit, and vice versa if you're a Conan fan picking it up for Lupin. But yeah, and that, and I'm probably going to do something similar for the movie version of that, which you know, it, yeah, it's to be perfectly blunt, Lupin versus Conan is not my personal favorite entry in the series, so it's been a little slow going, but I know some people are fans of it, so hopefully we do it justice.
Well, and you got to edit out all the swearing, right?
No.
Detective Conan, he's a foul-mouthed kid. okay, cool. So there's more Lupin coming, for sure, from Discotech. And, Brady, what have you been working on?
So, currently, man, I've got a ton of stuff going on. We're finalizing the packaging for Samurai Pizza Cats. I also helped proof the disc for that recently. Which is,
and this is the standard def Blu-ray.
Yeah, it is one huge disc with all the episodes of Samurai Pizza Cats. So if you have the worst insomnia, you could watch like 4 days of Pizza Cats straight through. Let's see, 20 was it 52 episodes? So it's like an entire day. You could just watch all Pizza Cats.
God.
And it's not, it's that's coming out. It's standard def on Blu-ray, so it's just, you know, all the episodes on one disc. Finalizing that, finishing up Vampire D Bloodlust, which I was sort of the producer on that. I mean, that's, you know, more or less, there's nothing extremely special on that. It's, if you have the old release, it's more or less in that wheelhouse where it's got the same stuff on it. We did a SDH audio track for it, though. SDH subtitle track for it. So, you know, you can, if you're deaf, you can watch the movie too, which I don't think that was on the old release. I might not be 100% sure, but it's on there now. So our deaf anime fans can watch the movie. Yeah, that's, you know, I was sort of the production person on that, getting everything together for that. I'm working on Darkstalkers. I'm doing packaging and production on that as well. That's coming together. Iria Zeram, the animation, which that's going to have new master. It's going to look a lot better than the old discs, and have the dub and all that on it, and a bunch of extras, and the packaging. And that's actually the slow part. That's almost completed, except for the packaging, which getting artwork for that has been kind of a chore. Working on that, and the big thing I'm working on, and Reed's helping a little bit with it, is Street Fighter, the animated movie.
Looking forward to that one.
Yeah, which is going to be fun, but also it's been a lot of work to track down all the dubs and everything for that. But I guess people will be happy because we have all the different dubs. We've got the one from the UK with the F-bombs. We've got the one from the US, which doesn't have F-bombs, but still has a lot of cussing. We've got the version that has no cussing. We've got all the different versions of it together, and it's just a matter of getting it synced to the new master. So that is something I'm sort of looking forward to working on, and it's going to be kind of a neat release. We're sort of figuring out what we can get for extras for that. We have to put together a proposal still. But yeah, that's either way, even without extras, that's going to be like a cool release because it's going to have all the things I think the fans have asked for on that release, and that I've wanted on a DVD release of it myself and a Blu-ray release of it, that hasn't happened yet. So that's going to hopefully be pretty cool.
Yeah, because for whatever reason, that movie has never really gotten a super special treatment, which is a bummer because it was like the first anime that I ever saw knowing that it was an anime. So it kind of holds a special place in my heart.
It's a fighting game anime, so it's not like the story's crazy good or anything, but it has really, really great animation in it and a lot of really good fight scenes, and it's sort of
what more do you need?
I mean, I'm not trying to, it's just for me, it's something that I watched when I was a kid, and it's still as animation it holds up, I think. Again, it's a fighting game, so there's not a huge super compelling story in there, but it's a fun little, you know, fighting anime with some of the best animation, so I think it deserves a better treatment than it's gotten before. And then I guess the final thing, after the Lupin and Conan specials, we can announce, this is, I don't think it's been announced yet, but we're working on Voyage to Danger, which is the next Lupin special we'll be putting out. So that's, I guess, an announcement for Ancast.
Okay, and that's a former Funimation release, right?
Yeah, it's going to be, should have the dub on it and you know, the Japanese version, new master, so it'll look better, have better compression and everything, so it'll look better, I guess. That's the next on the list for Lupin stuff.
Cool.
Yeah, not sure if there's gonna be in the way of extras, maybe some liner notes or something, but...
All right. Is that a good one?
I liked it. It's actually kind of noteworthy because the guy who directed the first TV series or started directing the first TV series and got fired and replaced with Miyazaki and Isao Takahata, everyone felt he kind of got the shaft by TMS because, oh, well, he didn't want to get the ratings up by making the show a kid's show. And so this was kind of their making it up to him movie. And so they let him direct this TV special. And so it kind of feels a little bit more gritty maybe than the TV specials that came before it or that immediately followed it. But anyway, so yeah, Masaki Ozumi, if I remember correctly.
Right, yeah. You know, there's nothing more hit and miss than Lupin TV specials. Like, you don't
true,
know if you're getting...
words may have never been said.
Like, you don't know if you're getting, like, a wacky, fun adventure with Lupin and friends or, like, the most nonsensibly plotted, just, like, messy-ass, like, weird... Everyone's acting out of character and the plot's really convoluted, like... I've seen some pretty bad Lupin specials, but probably not as many as you have, Reed.
Oh, yeah. I think I've seen all of them. I may have missed one. I don't think I finished Princess of the Breeze that came out a year or two ago. But but Voyage to Danger is pretty all right. I remember liking it the last couple times I saw it. And the character designs look different. By the way, a little trivia. I recently learned that Yasuo Otsuka, who did the first TV series, was at least at one point probably on tap to do those character designs. They were going to do like Fuma Conspiracy has his character designs. Like, I thought they looked like they were going to do it, but they changed their mind and went with this other guy. And it looks very different as a result. Like, they never used these character designs again. So it doesn't look bad. It just looks different. So if you're expecting Lupin to look XYZ, it looks more like, you know, LMNOPQ, you know, so.
Right.
I don't know. My favorite Lupin designs are the more characterized ones from, like, I really like the designs in Fujiko Mine and just, like, the ones, like, in Mamo and all that. Those are kind of my favorite. Voyage to Danger is not 100% my, like, favorite Lupin. It's not a bad special, but it's not where I, you know, sort of like Lupin, which I guess the good thing about Lupin is there's so many different versions of it that, like, I think you're, like, somewhere in there is a Lupin that you'll like. Like, I think there's somewhere in there as an anime fan, new, old, whatever, there's somewhere in there, there's a Lupin that you'd like.
Yeah, I think there's wisdom in that. Like, because if you really like Miyazaki Lupin, okay, well, there's a lot of his Lupin in there, and not all of it is even the same. Like, it varies a little bit from instance to instance. So it's, okay, well, if you watch the end of the second half of the first series, well, it's not all Miyazaki, so it's got a little extra flavor in there, and maybe that's more to your taste. Or maybe you prefer kind of the wacky hijinks of the second series, or, you know, maybe you like some of the maybe you just like really boring action movies. You can watch some of the later TV specials. I mean,
yeah, that's it's one of those things where it's like, I'm cool, totally cool with, because I'm not like a huge Lupin fan or anything. I like the series plenty. Fujiko Mania was such a huge step forward for me that it's like, oh, this is this is more what I'm interested in. But a lot of that had to do with the design of it, and the Lupin stuff that I think looks cool is the stuff from, you know, the mid 20th century, the old stuff, Cagliostro and Fujiko Mine. When it gets into the kind of glossy digipaint style of like the mid 2000s, and I guess like maybe the most recent stuff, like the Lupin and Conan thing, that's a turnoff. That to me looks like it's kind of like a coloring book version of the cool stuff they were drawing back in like the 70s.
Yeah, I think they get way more homogeneous as the 2000s waxed on. That decade was particularly, in my humble opinion, just really lacking in visual flavor.
Yeah, well, that's why I kind of check out. It's shallow, I know, but I kind of check out. If Lupin looks like that, I'm like, nah, I'm not interested. But if it looks like Fujiko Mine, I'm totally on board.
I hear you.
I think the biggest thing about Fujiko Mine is not only are the designs actually look interesting and new and different, like I don't know how big their budget was for that show, but I imagine that a lot of the design work, is in service of whatever the budget was. So they went with the more stylized, designs and animation, it looks like almost like sketches that are colored and animated, yeah. And it looks really cool. And I think that series was a sort of a big step forward in actually modernizing Lupin, which it sort of for a long time I think has sort of plodded along with sort of the same old thing for a while, and that
stagnated
was
stagnated for sure. Yeah,
and let's do something completely new. I mean, that's also why I'm kind of looking forward to this new series that's coming out because it seems like they're sort of harkening back a little bit to the older series, but they're trying something new with it as well, and it's got a different visual style to it, but it's not just like you said, a coloring book version of the older stuff. It looks like they're doing different things with the backgrounds and that kind of thing, and it looks interesting to me.
Yeah, like they're taking some cues from Fujiko Mine. They're not copying it, but they're kind of going, okay, let's do this, that, and the other thing. Let's do it our way. And put it out there, and like he mentioned about the backgrounds, like it's clear that they're doing some sort of CG rendering thing with all the background art, and but it looks good. Like at a glance, you wouldn't know.
Yeah, until you notice. Then once you notice. It stops looking good. But I don't know. Like it's similar to like Hanna-Barbera stuff. Like, not that Hanna-Barbera like looked great back then, but there's kind of a crunchy, kind of a rough around the edges, hand-drawn, handmade feel to it, where it just feels a little bit more authentic and a little bit more sincere and a little cooler than a modern, like a drawing of Scooby-Doo from last year, you know, versus one from 1972. Like, it's just, there is something about the older stuff that has that kind of organic feel to it. Lupin is exactly like that. And the new stuff is a turnoff. It's just like, I don't want to see these super glossy, like.
So you're telling me that like the really old, like original Scooby-Doo and Yogi Bear is somehow superior to Yogi's Great Escape?
I'm saying that.
Okay, just check.
Even though Yogi's head is disappearing in every other frame, and they can't animate their eyes to like stay fixed on one target for more than a couple of seconds, it's still
no.
Better.
It's quaint, but it's also compelling. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, there's something about it. Yeah, Lupin's the same way. I think the old stuff is just, you know, it's groovier, right?
That's a good guy. Yeah.
So
that's a good description. It's groovier.
So we've got some Twitter questions here.
I forgot one Lupin. The new Daisuke Jigen's Gravestone. I'm also working on that as well.
That's on Hulu, right?
Yeah, it's on Hulu. You can watch it now. It's pretty cool. It's in the same style, more or less, of the Fujiko Mine series. It has a bigger budget, obviously, since it's a movie, but it's really cool. It looks visually cool. I haven't gotten to watch a ton of it. I've got to skip around a little bit of it, but I'm looking forward to working on it and getting to watch it finally, so.
Okay, all right, let's get to these two questions. Jeff Tebbets asks, friend of the show, he wants to know, what aspects of the movie do you think serve as selling points to the young anime fans of today? Reed?
I guess that's me.
Well, there's no swearing.
Yeah, I don't think that's really a concern for most young anime fans, unless you're talking, you know, young. I don't know, it's a very painless way to go back and see. I mean, it's just a painless classic anime. Like, younger anime fans are probably being exposed to anime, I think, by and large, through what's on things like Crunchyroll and television and that sort of stuff. So if they kind of want to know their roots, Castle Cagliostro is what better example to go like, okay, well, here's something from the 70s. It isn't necessarily a straight-up example of everything you saw in the 70s. In fact, it probably really isn't. But at the same time, it's like, oh, okay, this is some of the some of the good stuff that came before. As far as, like, specific things I could call out about it, I mean, it's an old rendition of characters that are still being reflected today. It's a good action film. I mean, I don't know. I'm not really good at breaking down movies in this way.
I think as a film, what I like about it, it's a very sincere film, a very expressive film. I think it's a little different than a lot of things today, which are very, I don't want to say negative, but like looking towards the, how is it dark and edgy and how can we make this seem super, super violent and what have you. It's just a fun ride.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's trying hard to be something or to fit in with a certain clique or whatever of shows or to target a certain demographic, which I know, you know, certain things do feel like they're trying to mimic a certain other series or do that. It isn't trying to do that. It's just trying to be its own thing and to appeal to as many people as possible. And I think that's really one of its strong points.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fun ride, really. Like I said, very sincere and just fun and heartwarming. I think it's got a lot of those kind of things in it. I think if you like Disney movies, you should watch it because it has a lot in common with a lot of older Disney films.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna shelve it with the rest of the Ghiblis, you know, with the gold spines, but it looked out of place, so it went in with the other anime. Okay. Cowboy Dev asks, was there anything you wish you could have added to the Blu-ray? Anything that didn't make it in that you were like, aw shucks?
Cliffhanger. Yeah, cliffhanger. We tried and tried. We figured out who had the rights to cliffhanger. And of course they didn't have any of the contracts anymore. So we tried every way possible to try and include something from Cliffhanger, and we just couldn't make it happen, unfortunately. Yeah,
there was I've got a buddy who used to have a record on Cliffhanger, and so he's pretty knowledgeable about the game. He used to have the cabinet and all that, and we were going to have him do like a playthrough and run a playthrough of the game and have him do like a commentary about the game, and it never came to fruition. So
yeah, we just couldn't work out the rights to it, unfortunately.
Exactly.
But I mean, you know, you can Google Cliffhanger. I mean, the only thing we couldn't get that Yasuo Otsuka interview, but we were able to get different interviews, which are all interesting and more interesting in certain ways. So, you know, it's a sort of a trade-off. And honestly, if we got Cliffhanger, I don't understand like how we could have fit it anyway with all the stuff we had. So
yeah,
it's sort of a moot point anyway.
I'm going to toss my cookies. Like, I don't know if that was really – that's really worth the effort anyway. But,
you know, I'm sure to some people it was. Speaking of the Yasuo Otsuka interview, Megazone 2-3 Part 2, like a VHS of that, asked this question. He wants to know why couldn't you get that?
Like we said, we tracked down, we asked TMS. They said we didn't have the rights to this. We didn't make this. We tracked down Stars, who owns Manga's catalog now, pretty much absorbed them. And they had no no materials for it, and they just had no rights to it either. So we just could not include it, unfortunately. But honestly, you can just look for it online and find it if you really want to watch it. It's not really a huge loss, I don't think, especially because, like I said, we got a lot of different interviews, which have never been translated before, and included those instead, which I think sort of makes up for it. I think it's, you know, they're more a little more robust in certain areas anyway, I think, too.
Yeah, that interview isn't bad, but it's, you know, if you've got the disc, just keep it. Like, get the new stuff and keep the old disc if you want that interview. Because it's not a bad interview. It's worth watching, I think, at least once through. But yeah, I wish we could have put it on, but really, it's a pretty full disc again. So.
Okay. LT Discotech, I assume not related to the company, asks, how did you convince David Hayter to do the interview that's on the Blu-ray? And, you already answered the second part of this. So, how did you get David Hayter to do all that
stuff? Well, he contacted us. He was just like, hey, I love this movie. I mean, he is legitimately a fan of this movie. If you watch his interview, you can tell that he knows it like all the way through. Right. And he knows, and he can talk. He can talk, you know, very intellectually about it, and he loves the movie. I mean, like he watched it. He's watched it with his daughter a bunch of times too, apparently. But yeah, he contacted us. And it's like he said, anything you need, just ask me. And so we asked him for some stuff, and he did. He was very cool. He's one of those, you know, when they say don't meet your heroes, and he turned out to be, you know, one of the nicest, most charming guys I've ever met, who works in the Hollywood system. So it's very cool. It was very gratifying.
Brady's answer is a good one because he did the interview. So
Land of Obscusion asks, with Cagliostro now out of the way, what's the next most wanted Lupin, I guess no pun intended, that you want to work on? So, Reed, if you could take that one.
Sure. Well, Cagliostro was the one. Like, that was – if ever I got to work on a Lupin project, that was the one that introduced me to the franchise. And that was kind of my precious, my baby. And – now that that's out of the way, like, I don't really have one that I'm like, oh, I really want to get hunker down and have another Cagliostro heart attack on something. But if there was one that I had to pick over the others, it would probably be Series 2. Like, if we could work on Series 2, I think that would make a lot of people happy, and we could do some, you know, I just love doing research on stuff and going through TV episodes and going, oh, I wonder what they're talking about there, or I wonder what that's in reference to, and doing the research on that. That's actually pretty fun for me.
Yeah, I would have to agree. Series 2, I would love to get that all out on DVD just so it's the whole collection's out in English and everybody can watch all the way through it, and especially just to get those, you know, those Miyazaki episodes out there. I guess we didn't mention it, but we for this release, I went to my friend Shoko Ono, who she's a well-known translator. She did Excel Saga, and she's done all the Evangelions and all that sort of stuff. And she did a complete new translation of Cagliostro, like for the subtitle track. So it's completely new, and it has liner notes for the first time. And so I'd love to, for specifically those episodes, the Miyazaki ones on the second series, I'd love to get her to translate those as well, just so they have sort of a more polished translation than what's out there right now. Because I believe the only thing that really exists is what played on that one California station. So that's sort of what I would like to do, is get Series 2 out and get those two episodes out in a good, good, you know, preservation of those. Because they're two of my, besides Cagliostro, I really like those episodes as well. There's some, you know, a lot of fun and sort of amazing animation in that, those two little TV episodes. So those are mine.
Friend of the show, Brian Raw asks, has anyone ever been able to pin down the rumors that Spielberg saw Cagliostro in the 80s and that it influenced him?
I tried to contact DreamWorks to get an answer. It didn't happen. My suspicion is that it's not true. Like, I mentioned this in the commentary, actually, but I think probably what happened is someone like John Lasseter, who is openly enthusiastic about the film, said something praiseworthy or, you know, something along those lines. And then, you know, among the, you know, the rumor mill, they just like, well, it was Steven Spielberg because I saw him at the, you know, so it, I think that's what happened. It's like that rumor just kind of got blown out of proportion.
I don't think it's at all difficult to believe. In fact, it's highly likely he did see it back then.
Oh, yeah, no arguing that point.
That's highly likely. Whether or not it influenced him, yeah, that's another thing entirely, but I don't doubt that he saw it. Like,
oh, yeah, he probably saw it and he probably liked it, you know, or even really liked it. But the but well, the actual literal crazy quote that this car chase was specifically amazing, or that the movie is one of the greatest adventure films of all time, which is super high praise, but no one can source the quote. And in fact,
he would have repeated it at some point if he really felt that way.
Right, exactly. And Fred Patton, you know, used to work at Streamline, he said that Carl Masyk was really adamant about not using unsourceable information like that. And they were too small a company to go talking to Spielberg and say, hey, can you verify this quote for us? So they never used it on any of their promotional material. Manga was just like, yeah, what the heck? So.
Yeah, I don't even know where that came from. I just know that it's been on certain packaging. And we instead use the Lasseter quote, which is easily verifiable because it's like he's recorded saying it.
Yeah, I guess that was the next question, actually, was how that how that Lasseter quote came around, because it's a pull quote on the back of the box is from John Lasseter.
Yeah, it's actually from the beginning of the book, Starting Point, which he did a foreword on.
Ah, right. Yeah. I can just imagine John Lasseter saying it aloud and speaking to me as though I am a very small baby. That's kind of the way, that's the way he talks. He talks like that. He's like, "You're gonna just love this." And you're like, "Okay, John Lasseter, let's... You're at a 12. I need you to bring it down to like a 6 on the baby talk."
I don't suppose you're talking about the intros he did for for the Kiki and so forth.
We saw Inside Out like a couple of days early, and it was attached to it was this like behind the scenes, like it was just Pete Docter with a camera going around Pixar, and they like found John Lasseter in the story room for Toy Story 4, and he came out and he was, "Well, you guys can't come in here, but I love this movie that you made so much." And you're like, "Man, why are you pushing this like weird, like creepy uncle thing like so hard? Like, just like grandpa who's trying too hard. Like, tone it down, grandpa. I don't need a back rub."
But yeah, I mean, to answer his question, it's just we found the quote. And then we got it we verified the source, and then they were cool with using it because we had a source of him actually saying it. So there you go. There was no we didn't talk to him or anything. We just verified it and showed our proof.
He showed up at your house with a bunch of board games, and
he's like, "Hey, I really like this Cagliostro movie."
And then let's play Jenga. Yeah. Daniel Salter also wants to know if you went to Ghibli for anything.
We had our contact was TMS, so right. They might have. We did not personally. Okay. I do know that a lot of materials came from France. Kaze had a lot of stuff. Surprisingly, a lot of the artwork we were able to use came from Kaze in France, who very kindly provided that for us, and then we were able to restore a lot of it. But about Ghibli, I have no clue. No idea.
Yeah. Same.
Okay. Jose CNN asks, which of the dubs is your personal favorite? Reed, why don't you start?
Well, personal favorite dub used to be the Streamline dub because that was the one I'd seen a bazillion times. But, you know, as time went on and I realized that the dub was heavily adapted and had all sorts of changes, even though I think overall prefer the performances of the Streamline dub, I kind of got to go with the manga dub, at least the family friendly version. exactly. Just because I think it's more in line with the original intentions of the movie or the original intentions of the director. Because, well, I don't mind watching Robotech. I think it's fun, but you know, there's something to be said about watching Macross. You know, it's kind of the same thing with Cagliostro, like. I think Carl's heart was in the right place when he adapted Cagliostro for the widest audience possible, but he changed some of the plot points, and it's just it doesn't feel the same as watching the original intention. So
you're saying that the original manga dub is like Robotech, and the family friendly dub that you edited?
No! Don't you go screwing over. I mean, the Streamline dub is more like watching Robotech, and then it has some of the same voices, but the manga dub or family friendly version are more like watching what Miyazaki actually had intended. And it's not perfect, but if I'm going to watch an English version, I'm leaning toward that. And plus, I've really warmed up to Hater as Lupin, because originally I was kind of like, when I would watch the dub, it seemed like the mouth was just like flapping over, like someone was narrating over a muted Lupin is what it felt like to me, because I couldn't pair the voice and the face. But as time's gone on, it's like, no, he really did a good job. And I don't know why it didn't. I was probably just too married to the old dub.
Well, you know what they say. Hater's gonna hate.
That's a 2 on a 5 scale.
I'm just letting this pause play out after that. all right.
I mean, I mostly agree with Reed. I was introduced by the Streamline one. My first introduction to this movie was my buddy Devin was like, "Hey, you got to watch this you got to watch this movie, Castle of Cagliostro. You got to watch it. And I was like, what's that Lupin thing? I don't know. That looked a little old for me. Like, it looks old. And then he showed it to me. And this was in the 90s. Like, oh, my God, this is so amazing and great. And so I have, like, really fond memories of that dub. And, in fact, when I ended up buying the manga version, I was so turned off by the dub, the manga version dub, within the first 5 minutes, because it's just so unlike that movie, just with a lot of the, you know, the cursing choices. And I'm not really a prude, like, you know that, Zach, but it just seemed just so out of place for the movie that dub turned it off, turned me off. And then afterwards, after working on it for a while, having to watch it a bunch, I became a really big fan of it. So I'm sort of leaning towards the same as Reed.
Oh yeah, and by the way, I know my voice is part of the family friendly dub, and I don't remember if yours still is or not, Brady.
Nope.
Oh, okay. It was at one point, at least in one point in production, his voice was in there too.
Wait, but just you like, put your own voice in the family friendly dub?
Well, yeah, because we didn't have the original.
Not only did you
by those actors.
Not only did you edit out all the swear words, you put yourself in the dub, and now you're saying that this is the Macross to the original dub's Robotech.
You are so horrible, Reed.
No,
like,
I just
the praise for
like
this
I said,
thing
even the manga
going.
Dub without the cursing or with the cursing is a fine way to watch the movie. But I'm just saying that the anyway, I got nothing.
We're gonna get to a point where it's like, well, if you had to ask me what I thought the greatest achievement in human history was, I would have to go with the family friendly dub.
Literally, Reed picked up two lines, I think, and you can't tell, and you probably won't be able to tell who it is or what character it is. Uh-huh. It's so inconsequential.
Well, when he's picking up his best supporting actor trophy, we'll know.
Yeah, for saying, well, I'll be.
Is that the line?
Okay, thanks for spoiling it.
Is that the line?
No, there's a line where originally he cursed, and then we just shortened the line to just be, well, I'll be. And we just basically extended the B a little bit. And that was it. That's the only change.
I'm just giving you a hard time, Reed. You know that.
I do.
All right. I like this question from Tom Tifikit. He asks, so you've seen Cagliostro. You introduce someone to Lupin. They watch that movie because it's the obvious first thing that you show them. What do you show them next to get them to keep watching Lupin? Like, if you want them to stay interested in this franchise, what do you show them next?
I'd probably show them the two other Miyazaki episodes from Series 2. And then probably, if you really want to sort of bait and switch them, show them Fujiko Mine and then get them to go back to the older stuff. Because I think you're right in that that probably resonates more with people now. It's easier to get people into that show. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would agree with that, because it seems like a lot of people had like a knee-jerk reaction against the show, you know, because of things like, you know, the feminist messaging and things like that that people didn't care for. I can't speak to a lot of that because I haven't seen the show 100%. So, but I would not necessarily say you shouldn't do that, but that's anyway, as you were. I would say Fuma Conspiracy, by the way, would be my answer.
Yeah, I was going to say you should answer that question. Fuma Conspiracy is pretty good. I've seen that. A long time ago. It's been a long time since I've seen the film Conspiracy. I should fix that. Okay. Julian Moraine wants to know, how do you decide what sets get inside art versus which don't?
Oh, this is for me, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's how it's decided. So I work on a lot of old shows. Not all the shows have a lot of artwork. If I get a show that has a lot of artwork, it gets inside artwork. If it doesn't have a lot of artwork, it doesn't get inside artwork.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes. It's just like, if we have materials, you're going to get every piece of artwork we have. Like, you will get all of it. Usually. So if there's, like, something that doesn't have art, you know, it's because the company that licensed it didn't get the materials. Usually.
Oh, pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and the thing is there's a lot of back and forth trying to get more artwork, and sometimes they can find it, sometimes they can't. You know, you got to sort of roll with the punches, and sometimes if you don't get a lot of good artwork, you got to be creative. So, you know, it's all case by case. Everyone's different.
Case by case. Get it? Ha! Because the packaging, anyway.
Holy shit. Okay, I think with that, we're going to wrap up. But it was great having you on to talk about your experiences putting that disc together, because I know it was a long year of your life, and
yes.
Yeah, the result speaks for itself. So, all right, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us, Zach.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Reed and Brady for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And I'll see you all next week.